to this Harmony and Health podcast. My name is Julia Outlaw, and I'm one of the Harmony and Health team. And together we're exploring harmony and bringing together ancient wisdom and modern disciplines to find practical ways to increase your own health and well-being. And today's podcast is about well-being and the environment around you, and particularly the well-being of children and adults in schools, and thinking about the spaces within schools. And I'm really excited and interested in this one, and delighted to welcome Emma Dyer. Welcome, Emma.
Thank you.
Nice to see you.
Thank you.
Now, Emma is a researcher. She's an educational advisor and a writer. And her doctorate was in education and architecture. And Emma works with precious spaces, as she calls them. So she goes and works for three local authorities in Southwest London, and goes and works with schools, really, to design precious spaces for the children and adults, small spaces and ones that can be used for children that really need a little extra support. And we're going to hear all about that today. Welcome, Emma.
Thank you very much.
Maybe first I can ask you, what sort of environments do you feel well in?
Well, I think I'm the sort of person that really likes a smaller, cozy space. So I do like spaces that are quite protected, not large spaces. I feel quite nervous going into sort of large halls and things like that. But at the same time, I do love the light. I don't like spaces to be too dark. So yeah, I'm really aware of the spaces that I go into and how they make me feel, actually. I'm often, you know, working in an office or working in a school, I feel the impact of that space. And I suppose that's how I got into this work, really. I started my work in a school where in the East End of London, a school that's built around the 1910s, I think. And I was working in a room without any windows, and I did have a skylight, but I had to do all sorts of things to make it possible to stay for a long time in that room. Found it really hard. So,
like what? I'm interested.
Well, I brought in some small lamps so that I didn't have to turn the sort of strip lighting on, because that was really harsh. And I put loads of really brightly coloured pictures all over the walls, and postcards and things like that, and pictures of the outside world. And that sort of helped me to feel that I wasn't just in a very enclosed sort of dark space, really. And also I was working there with children. I was teaching reading, and I didn't want them to come and feel that they were in some sort of prison-like room, which it could have been. And that really started me thinking about the difference that it makes towards a child's learning, or how a child's feeling, as well as the adults that work with them in schools, really. That was the start of it, I think, that room. So I'm quite grateful to that room, even though it was a bit, to start with, a little bit difficult to be there for a long period of time.
Yes. And you used to be a teacher?
Yes. So I started as a classroom teacher. Well, before that, I was a researcher with the BBC, actually, for quite a while. And then I moved into teaching when my daughter was about five. So we were sort of moving up year groups together. And which was really nice, not in the same school. She would have hated that. And classroom teacher. And then I went to work for a charity promoting author visits to school. And then I got a job as something called a reading recovery teacher, which is where you work with children who are in year one. So they're children who are sort of 6 to 7 years old. It was a huge program in London, and outside the country, but especially in London, in the sort of 2010s, or just before that, really, and got very massively cut, I suppose, about 5 years later. So, but it was a big program to really boost very young children's reading skills so that they wouldn't get left behind their peers, really. And so children would be taken out of the classroom for half an hour a day for a period of about 10 to 12 weeks to really sort of give them the confidence to become confident readers. And then hopefully at the end of the program, they would reach that state and wouldn't need to come out of the classroom for extra lessons again. So that was the program that I was working on.
Yes. And I want to talk about the spaces as well, because I know your doctorate was about reading spaces, particularly for beginner.
Yeah, so that's how I came across the possibility of this doctoral study and thought, how can I use this to explore reading and reading spaces, thinking very much of the effect that those spaces had on children. And I think what I'd really noticed in terms of their well-being as much as anything else, really, and their confidence and their feelings of empowerment and how they felt. I became very aware that in the school building, there were lots of places that were very public spaces. I mean, most of the places in school buildings are very public. You know, perhaps even only the toilets are not public spaces for children. And that there were lots of children that were really struggling to read or to speak out, to find their voice really in the classroom. But when they went to a different space, to a sort of more protected space, a space where they felt a bit safer, you know, then they had a very strong voice and they learned very quickly. But what I realized that was when they went back into the classroom, they'd often again find it difficult to sort of demonstrate that strong voice and that ability to read to other people because they felt very self-conscious. And I just noticed how very, very public our education system is, really, and how hard it is for children to find those spaces where they can just take a bit of time out or just replenish themselves or, you know, perhaps work with another adult to just boost a skill or a confidence, whatever it is, or talk to another adult. So that was my interest, and I ended up working with a fantastic furniture designer in Sheffield, and they made for me a little reading nook. And so part of my project was to take that reading nook into schools and to see how children used it as a sort of more private space within their classrooms. So I took them to two schools. They actually built it to make sure it was very safe. We took them into two schools in London, and children just did so much amazing sort of playful work in there, you know, were kind of released somehow. And I think sharing books and playing with books and just playing a bit actually became quite a joyful space when they were able to go inside those nooks. And it was really interesting to create a different type of space inside a classroom that wasn't the performative assessed space that they experience for most of the rest of the time that they're in classrooms, because obviously assessment is a huge thing these days. And, you know, they weren't being watched, they weren't being judged, they weren't being listened to. And I was looking at how a differently designed, very much child scaled space, so a space that was comfortable and protected and scaled to the child's body, would affect their, or just would change the way perhaps that they experience the classroom and experience reading.
It's so interesting, Emma, and I really feel it's so important, you know, having a bit more experience in schools recently myself and just really being aware, like you say, of that classroom environment and, you know, the tables and chairs packed in, all those different personalities of children there, you know, just like us, you know, some of us are more introvert than others, some, you know, need to be outside more, some need to move more, and yet they all have to be in this same space for most of the day, really. Yeah. And in a similar sort of style, like I was interested, you're saying it was quite performative and assessment atmosphere in that space. maybe because of just the way that it's set up, but also the work that they're doing in there. And should that be how they're spending most of their childhood in that kind of environment?
Yeah, I'm not sure that that's right at all. You know, there's so many, and of course it is a political decision to put children in buildings that aren't, you know, that might have been designed over 100 years ago and that aren't well designed for their bodies and for the way that they learn. And you know, the times of day that they learn and how they learn, it's just been sort of passed down and passed down and passed down. It can be extremely regimented. You know, is that the furniture might be the right height for some children, not for others. They're very different shapes and sizes. And there's no sort of flow. Is there an opportunity to move around the classroom? Probably not very much. You know, I know that in year one, where children are sort of 6 and 7, often seated cross-legged on a carpet or at a desk, and, you know, they have playtimes and they have PE and, you know, but there's so much emphasis on reading and writing and getting, you know, being able to read and write to a certain standard, and that's it. So I think my work is very much working with what we've got, I suppose. I think I'm trying to be really pragmatic, and, you know, I would love to work with designers on a school or the way of thinking about schools that is completely different. But, you know, we are where we are. We've got a national curriculum, which is very strongly imposed. You know, we've got phonics, we've got certain ways of teaching certain things. And I felt like I needed to work with what's there rather than to just let my imagination go wild. Unfortunately, I just thought that, you know, it's a more practical approach, and for me at the moment.
Absolutely. I think there are children there, and actually sometimes small changes can have quite a big impact on quite a few children.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I think that's very much part of my work. It's about, I think we teachers, you know, and I speak as an ex-teacher and, you know, head teachers and senior leadership teams and governors and everyone that works in schools become completely habituated to how things are in schools, and actually they could be a bit different even within the constraints of what we've got. And I think if we can just look at things differently, and when I say look at things differently, actually I don't mean look at things differently, I actually mean sort of experience with all our senses the environment around us differently. I think we realize that there's a lot more possibilities and opportunities than if we just look at a space. There was a Finnish architect who I really enjoyed the work of. He's called Palasma, and he wrote a work called The Eyes of the Skin. And it's just very much about he talks about how there's a real sort of ocular fascination and how it's always about looking at things, you know. And often when you look at, you know, architecture designs and magazines and things like that, it's about the look, and, you know, you see these lovely pictures of the outsides of buildings, but, you know, he's really interested in the textures and the smells and the sounds, and, you know, these are all crucial to children's well-being and also to children's learning. And
yes,
you know, if you're learning to read in a corridor right by some very smelly toilets, that, you know, it's a disruption. If you're, you know, let's think about those, you know, those really visceral things that happen in schools. You know, if you're learning to read or to do something or you're having some counselling in a dining room where they're setting up for lunchtime and there's tables being moved and furniture and plates and cutlery and things like that, you know, it's noisy and difficult. And I think it's just a question of remembering as teachers that we are human bodies, you know, and that children are too, and that scale and fresh air and light and sound, all these things are going to have an impact on us. And, you know, it might not be the biggest impact out of everything in schools, but I just think it's really important and can make a significant difference, really.
Yes, I agree. And let's talk about these the precious spaces that could sort of be carved out or that you sometimes work with. So you mentioned, you know, counselling, because I know quite often in schools for particular groups of children, whether there is a dyslexia or a learning need, or whether they're children perhaps in care or they need some extra attention, schools do bring in counsellors and therapists quite often to work with the children, don't they? And your experience, sometimes there's not a designated space for that work to happen in a sort of protective, enriching environment.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm sort of looking at the moment, really, primarily, because I mean, all the schools, so I work with, it's something like 188 schools across the three boroughs. And, you know, I'm not only working with the spaces, but that's part of my work. And, you know, out of those schools, I don't think there's a school that doesn't have a school counsellor or a therapist or an ELSA. You know, there's all, most schools have at least one of those people who come in regularly. And I was working with an educational psychologist called Sarah Freitag, and we were thinking about, well, how do, you know, these adults that are working in schools, you know, they're being really invested in, you know, they're being sometimes staff that are being trained to do this work. So a lot of money is being invested in this work. And then, you know, they might find themselves working in a corridor or working in a room where they're being interrupted all the time. You know, is that really maximizing their potential? Because they have so much potential, and there's such a need for children, you know, who are struggling in class with their emotions, or, you know, who are having a really difficult time at home or have anxiety, that, you know, there's such a huge need at the moment. And
there is a huge need that's growing, isn't it?
Yeah,
mental health
definitely
in children is scary, really, and the
absolutely
increasing rates of ADHD, which, you know, if you call it that, but, you know, children who are not sort of comfortable maybe in their own skin or in that environment.
I was just going to say, I think these adults who are working in schools often just can make a massive difference, because, you know, these children might not have the chance to talk to any other kind of adult that they trust about what they're going through or they're feeling. I mean, certainly, you know, waiting lists for CAMHS and other services are huge, and, you know, they might not have another adult at home that they can talk to about what they're feeling. But this is such valuable work. And I suppose what Sarah and I were thinking about was, how can we maximize that potential, you know, and how can we just ensure, try to empower those professionals, really, to create spaces for themselves in schools where they feel comfortable and where children feel comfortable. So sort of emotionally, acoustically, you know, a place where children can talk without fear of being interrupted or overheard, or, you know, and obviously there's safeguarding issues, you know, this is within that sort of framework. So, you know, very carefully thought through in terms of safety for children and adults. But, you know, children can't necessarily express themselves to their friends or in, you know, in these public spaces in schools. And we really wanted them to maximize that opportunity to have spaces where they could just talk or even just sit and have a different space from the classroom, really. So
yes. And what were these spaces like, Emma? So, like, what's the sort of non-negotiables or the ideally?
Yes, unfortunately, I think non-negotiables are it's really difficult.
They're always negotiable. Yeah,
they're always negotiable. But I suppose the primary element, so these spaces are sort of likely to be sort of a big store cupboard or a classroom that isn't being used, or, you know, an office that perhaps isn't being used. I mean, there are lots of rooms where things are dumped, you know, and there's lots of equipment or a printer or, you know, old chairs, or so they're probably sort of neglected, forgotten spaces. They might not be. There might be a perfectly lovely space ready, but so they're the spaces that are have a lot of potential to transform at very little cost. So and I'd say the most important things really are that the person who's using the room is able to manage it so that they aren't interrupted, and that there aren't sort of, you know, very loud noises outside. There aren't, you know, there's enough light, But, you know, if you can perhaps, as I did with that little reading space, rather than having a harsh strip light, you know, maybe you can have some soft lighting. You can bring a couple of lamps in or find some, you know, comfortable furniture. I mean, teachers are brilliant at, you know, borrowing or, you know, finding on Freecycle or whatever furniture that's a bit different from the school. So, you know, you want the room to feel different from, it's not an institutional space. I think that's really key. It's a space where it's different from school, where a child can just sort of take a breath, you know, and for that you need the adult to be comfortable as well. So they need to have, you know, so hopefully some ventilation. You know, I suppose non-negotiables is if it's just so stuffy and you can't breathe, or, and I've certainly come across rooms like that in schools. I think it's often an issue with a window, that it's very difficult to find windows, rooms with windows, especially if they're cupboards. But I think for me, non-negotiable, especially if you're teaching reading or if you are counselling, is a corridor. I think that is just too distracting, you know, too difficult. It's, you know, people come past, and that little reading room I was talking about, there was actually an office on the other side of it, and the only way to get to the office was to come through my little room. And so a lot of very lovely, friendly adults would come through and sort of lean over the child who was trying to read. Say, oh, what are you reading? Oh, and you could see the child just sort of shrinking down, go, oh no, don't talk to me. You know, they didn't want to be kind of questioned or so. And I also, corridor spaces, you know, I've come across so emotional literacy support assistants, ELSAs, who are working in a corridor, and, you know, as everyone goes past, they speak or do something, or, you know, children and adults. So that, I mean, that for me is the non-negotiable, really. If you can have a space that's protected in some way. And I'd also say, if you're setting up a space, you know, sit in all the different parts of it, sit down in, you know, different parts at different times of day as well, because schools are very much based on sort of routines and timetables. And, you know, it might be incredibly noisy at a particular time because it's near to the dining room or where assemblies take place, or, you know, people might interrupt at certain points to come in and fetch something. So I'd say, you know, really take your time and be in that space in different times of day if you can. It might be the only space you've got, and, you know, people are very grateful to have that, to have a therapy space. But sometimes there are alternatives, and it's that idea of habituation again, that we need to just kind of be a bit more imaginative and imagine the potential of spaces that perhaps haven't been looked at so far.
Yes, yes. And it did make, especially sort of storage areas, I imagine there is quite a few schools with some sort of bits that could maybe be.
Yeah. Are those items ever going to be used again, to be honest? But possibly not, you know, or could they be put somewhere else?
And in terms of in the room, Emma, then, the sort of some comfortable furniture, lighting, hopefully ventilation, hopefully private. I know before you talked about putting lots of things on the walls. My impression from school is they have so many things on the walls.
Yeah.
And it can sometimes be a bit overstimulating.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And I think I probably wouldn't decorate a room in that way now. I think I'd like I'd want the room to have some personality, but that might be plants, or it might be, you know, little objects. You know, if you can have shelving put up with nice things to look at on the shelves. But yeah, no, nothing to do with learning. I mean, no times tables, no, you know, none of that. No, I'm not a huge fan of motivational sort of mottos myself. I know some people love them, but yeah, I mean that might be helpful for some adults working there. But yes.
It just sounds more like a sort of homely environment, really.
Exactly, exactly. And there's a wonderful architect, actually, she was really sort of at the height of her powers in the sort of 1940s, 50s and 60s, called Mary Medd,
yes.
M-E-D-D. And she she really thought about all this stuff. I mean, she wasn't designing little spaces, she was designing whole schools, but she really tried to make schools feel like home, you know, where children could explore their interests, their own interests, and move around. That was a huge thing for her. I mean, her and her husband also worked with her, David Med, and, you know, they used to put little ladders in the classrooms and things. Children could climb up ladders. And she really thought about and closely observed children's bodies. So she worked a lot with younger children, and she was looking at, you know, well, how do they sit? Well, they might not sit. They might just sprawl on the floor, you know. Have they got the chance to do that? Have they got, you know, comfortable places? She designed little sort of nooks, which she called kivas, I think, you know, little secret places. But it just reminds me sort of, you know, children's lovely rooms with bunk beds, and, you know, there's all those ideas of kind of dens, and there might be a formal space, but, you know, where you, if you need a desk, that's, you know, that is part of learning, but you don't always need a desk. You might want to just do stuff on the floor. And
especially when they're little.
Exactly.
They're just still developing, and, you know, their bodies, and also their, you know, their cognitive development. And I mean, back to the reading, it seems, you know, I know obviously in other countries in Scandinavia, and they don't teach reading so young.
No.
And it's not just the sort of, have they got the words or the way to speak the letters, but also just even turning pages or holding the book, or actually wanting to engage with something like that, as opposed to what's around them, or like you say, climbing and being outside.
Absolutely. And I think if I think sometimes the reading becomes a really fearful experience for a lot of children who just don't think they can do it or don't want to invest in it. And when I was doing my research, I talked to a lot of children who would just say, I'd say, well, why don't you like reading, or what? They just go, oh, it's so boring. And you knew as soon as they said boring that they actually meant they just didn't. They hated it. They were afraid of it. It was a pressure on them, you know, and they felt overwhelmed by it. And I think also we don't think enough about the physicality of reading. You know, the lovely thing about reading recovery, which was dreamed up by somebody called Marie Clay in New Zealand, she would spend, and as a reading recovery teacher, you do this, you'd spend at least a week just exploring shapes and textures, and you'd get sand and you'd play sort of, you know, make marks and patterns in the sand, and you'd sit next to the child in a sort of at their height, you know, make sure that they were comfortable, and you'd help them to sort of discover how to turn pages. And, you know, you'd really think about that physicality. And I think that's such an important part of learning, that especially with reading, you know, we need, there's so much that you have to do to learn to be a reader. You have to get your eyes going in the right direction to focus, you know, you have to read aloud for people to check that you're reading correctly. There's an awful lot of physical engagement, and I think children need to be comfortable and to do that, you know.
Yeah, like we sort of have to get up and move around, and you know, I'm sure lots of adults, especially with desk jobs, hold a lot of tension. And I'm interested in sort of embodiment and how to link, you know, the minds and bodies, really, and emotions for children and in schools, and how they're not sort of always taught as separate things. And when you're describing playing with sand and making marks, you know, that's more of a connecting activity for them, and something that sort of can integrate. And then you feel, like you say, you can breathe, and then maybe be less fearful, because fear is obviously not going to help you're comfortable in your body.
It's a huge part. I'd say at least half of the children that I taught actually learned incredibly quickly, because a lot of it was fear and lack of confidence. You know, they could really read almost. They were almost there, but they just couldn't make that step, you know. And I actually, at one point, I was trying to sort of see, is there a point where they just go over into being able to do it? And I think there is. I think there's a point where they just, where they're relaxed enough to do it, you know. They believe they can do it. I suppose it's like riding a bike, isn't it? There's all these things you have to master and you have to believe that you can do it, and then you can. And I think reading is as physical as that, really. So
yes. And with the pressure spaces, Emma, have you sort of evaluated those or their impact, or is it
just in the process of doing that at the moment, actually? So I work with quite a lot of educational psychologists, and we work on a lot of training for schools in attachment and trauma. And so we kind of look at those spaces quite a lot through that attachment and trauma lens of, you know, how do those spaces support the students in school? Our local authorities have been doing a training in attachment and trauma, and for part of that they do a project. And I think about maybe a quarter, a third of the schools have chosen to create a space or to think more deeply about a particular space as a therapeutic space as part of that project. So at the moment we're just sort of, you know, waiting to see how those develop. But it's something that, you know, has been an incredibly popular choice for a project, and so many schools have just been so keen to just think a bit more differently about their spaces and how they set them up, and to have that place where, you know, children can go when they are feeling dysregulated, or, you know, just it's too much for them to be in the classroom. So it's we're just in the process, really, of having a look at what the impact is of those spaces. But of course it's really hard to evaluate, you know, because I guess, you know, a lot of the metrics that are used are things like attendance or attainment, and actually maybe it won't mean that student attains more GCSEs or whatever it is, you know, but hopefully they'll feel more comfortable and safe. Hopefully it will make them feel safer in school. You know, so, but that sort of data evaluation, it's tricky. It has to be a bit more qualitative, really. Yes, that's what we're thinking.
Yeah. And I guess for the therapist as well, the feedback from them.
Absolutely.
Of having sort of more of a space.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's really hard to pay attention to how something will make you feel better. I suppose it's easier to know how it makes you feel worse, but I think at least for those professional therapists and counsellors and ELSAs and people, you know, for them to feel they've got some agency over a space would be very desirable. You know, I hope that they feel that they're in control of that space as much as they can be in a school building. So and that the children are also, you know, have a huge involvement in contributing to what they want from the space and how they want to sit and where they want to sit. And, you know, do they want to sit really close to the door because that makes them feel safer, or does it make them feel safer to be far away from the door in case somebody comes in? You know, those individual choices. I think if a space has that sort of flexibility, which a classroom often doesn't, then, you know, everyone who uses it has more choices about how they use it. And I think that really helps with well-being.
Yes, and it's making me think about sort of general well-being and all the things we've talked about, really. And we talk often about these sort of four pillars of well-being, given that you need to move, you need to rest, you need to be fed, and not just sort of nutrition, food, but also feeding the senses. And then you also need to feel safe and joyful and sort of connected inside and with others. And, you know, why not a school aim for, and given the constraints they've got, are there things in each of those areas that they can, you know, help the children?
I think when you were talking about those areas, I think all of them are, you know, are possible. And I mean, obviously, you know, there are lots of lovely things that happen in classrooms that can nourish children and can make them feel safe. But I suppose, you know, if you have other types of spaces in schools that are, as we talked about, homely, but, you know, they can be quite imaginative spaces. They're spaces where I think primarily the safety aspect, where children feel comfortable and safe. where they can move around if the space is large enough. You know, it doesn't mean they have to run around. I mean, sometimes, you know, I talk to a therapist and they spend a lot of their time walking around the field with a child, you know, or walking outside. And that's brilliant if you've got the chance to do that, I think. But also, I think it's that capacity to move, you know, not to be having to sit in a certain posture in a chair at a desk. You know, these spaces are places where you can, hopefully, if you want to lie on the floor, you can, you know, it's that sort of freedom to express yourself physically and emotionally. And
the same advice, I guess, for people outside schools, you're just thinking about people listening, maybe.
Of course, yes. I know I've spoken very specifically about schools, and they are very particular places, I think. But of course, you know, it is common sense, you know, a lot of this. It's not anything that's inaccessible to people, I think. It's what we'd want for ourselves. I was talking to somebody in a school, and she was in her office, and I was just admiring the way that she'd set up her office. It was, you know, she had a kettle, and she had a, you know, she could have hot drinks, and she had some nice things from home on the shelves. And it was, I don't know, some nice pictures, and it was just really nice, a comfortable chair. And she was saying, oh, I just don't know how to arrange this room that we've been given. It's a very small room. I was thinking, well, you've done it in your office. It's lovely. You know, it's a lovely space. You know, it's just that sort of thing, really.
Yes. Yeah, a space that you feel comfortable in. And so interesting, Emma. And thinking, you know, what about the future, really, and the way that things are going, and obviously we can't predict. But what's your sort of hope or wish for schools, for children?
I hope that, I mean, you know, I think I said before, you know, it's a political choice how much to invest in schools and to invest in school designs. And at the moment, we're going along a model of just building new schools as cheaply and as quickly as possible, or, you know, spending just patching up, you know, and so many schools are in a very bad way. There isn't that investment in them. But I would like to see teachers and children valued in an environment where they spend so much time every day, so many hours. I'd like teachers to be able to talk to architects and designers and feel confident that they can make a difference to their environment. It's not all about, you know, display boards or having things on the wall. It's about their own comfort, and so that they feel better in their jobs, and that the children they work with feel more comfortable, and that they can move. And, you know, as you said, with the four pillars, you know, they've got more potential, I suppose. They can realize their potential more. That sounds a bit airy-fairy, doesn't it? But I, you know, it's difficult to know how that would go without a sort of financial investment, but also without perhaps a bit more respect for what children and teachers do in school every day, and how difficult it is to do those jobs, and how difficult it is to be a pupil or a student in a school, and that, you know, to have a bit of confidence that actually we could make those buildings nicer. Just need to see things and feel things and remember our bodies when we're there, you know, remember that children aren't just bringing their bodies to school, they're bringing, you know, their emotions to school, they're bringing, you know, it's a whole package. It's not just a child who is there to attain a certain result and then, you know, off they go to the next place. It's a really important space. And, you know, libraries are beautifully designed, public libraries. Could we not think in that way for schools, you know, or and just have a bit more care, I suppose. That is not to criticise any schools or teachers, but some investment would be good.
Thank you, Emma. Yes, these precious, precious beings and all of the people and the teachers and the precious spaces we can hope towards. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today and talking all through this. Much food for thought.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thanks for listening.